Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. Today, we're going to be talking about the oceans again and environmental health. You know, what I have found interesting, it's basically been, from my perspective at least, in the last year, we've seen a significant citizen awakening around ocean health. It's kind of a macro trend that we've seen in the U.S., especially, that's been instigated by a younger generation of dealing with or associating the problems we've had within a shrinking planet. So, returning to the oceans, where 70% of our shrinking planet is blue, and for years the oceans have acted as our trash receptacle, probably for the last 40 years, we've been running a situation with our sanitation and waste that our oceans have been the never-never land to throw things away and not worry about. And if it didn't affect me, then so be it. And so what's happened, though, is through our footprint, our increasing footprint, and the volumes of types of trash we're putting out there, that approach is changing. It's changing relatively quickly through that citizen awakening. So we've seen this, really. I'm going to attribute this to the fact that human population in that 40-year period, 50-year period, has actually grown from 3.5 billion people to 7 billion people. And it also happened to coincide with more access to these resources. And really what's been a huge issue that's become somewhat of the limelight is the non-biodegradable plastics. We've seen them come to light in the ideas of a floating island in the Pacific. We've seen the bloating and choking off of all the baleen whales that come up and swallow this as they try to get the plankton. We've also seen this, and I think this is maybe the equivalent of the Native American crying for the trash on the land, but the sea turtle that has the six-pack hanger around its neck when it tries to grow, or bird, that maybe would be the equivalent of the common perspective that people have of this. But all of this is now becoming more in the limelight, more aware. What are we going to do about these? These are major, major problems that need systemic and broad change. And as we like to do here on Sourcing Matters, is to focus on those solutions of change. And before I introduce our guest, I want to share with everybody my pet peeve. Let me tell you my pet peeve here. It's when you go and you get a trash receptacle and you got a recycling bin right next to each other, and you're waiting to use it, waiting patiently, and the person walks over and takes that plastic water bottle and sticks it in the trash bin. You know, I'll be honest, I used to be the guy that would come up there all like wound up and like huffing and puffing, like who is this, like making a point so they understood and heard me. Now I just kind of pull it out, take it. I dumpster dive. I pull it out. I put it in the recycling, because if we're not going to do it, then who is going to do this? And even if I'm presenting this as an opportunity that kids seeing us do the right thing, well, okay. So let's start with small baby steps. So that's my pet peeve, right? There's a problem, I guess, I have, and I've learned to deal with my own issues with that. But maybe we're moving ourselves in the right direction by looking more holistically at this. So let's talk about this with our guest today. We have two experts that have come to join us, and they're actually guests that are coming from the world of academia. And we haven't had too many folks within academia talk to about what's happening with this extensive research. So today we're joined by Dr. Robin Hannigan, who's the founding dean of the School of the Environment at UMass Boston. Hey, Robin, how you doing?
Hey, Aaron. It's good to see you.
You too. We're longtime friends. I appreciate you taking the time to come on over here from Dorchester and sit down and share some thoughts.
It's my pleasure.
And we're also joined by Dr. Michael Talusti, who is the associate professor of sustainability and food solutions at the School of the Environment at UMass. Hey, Michael.
How are you doing?
I'm well. Do you share my issue with a pet peeve of watching people stick the plastic water bottles in the trash? Are you as crazy as I, standing over people's shoulders being like, hey, get that out of here?
It's more the compost thing. Like when they're just dumping food waste in the regular trash and not separating it out.
Yeah.
But even worse are when you get a cocktail and they put those two little straws in it. Like, why? Nobody drinks through those. There's
another great example, Michael, of the awareness coming out about plastic, of people going to biodegradable straws or no straws at all.
Yeah.
Like, I'm saving the planet. I'm not. I'm drinking right from the glass.
Yeah.
No straw today.
Right.
All right, Robin, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
So I've had the chance to come check out the new UMass Boston campus. That place is stunning. And I know you've put your time in dealing with all of the construction issues. Yeah. Many days spent in your old facility, and now this new state-of-the-art, incredible location right on the waterfront, Boston Harbor. Wow. I mean, there are really not many facilities like this around the country.
It is a big wow.
So could you tell us a little bit about what your focus is at the School of the Environment? And then, now that you have these new resources, tell us a bit about the new buildings, the new resources, the new initiatives that you'll be tackling at the School of the Environment.
Sure. Well, about the construction, we're about to enter about 9 months of no construction on our campus before we start demolishing buildings. So we're very excited about that. So the School for the Environment was founded from an evolution. So in academia, the way it usually goes is they establish a department of, worm science. And then worm science stops being a thing, but the Department of Worm Science exists in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
School for the Environment is actually an evolution of a series of different modified environmentally ocean-focused programs that were designed specifically to solve a problem. So in terms of your pet peeve about, putting bottles in the wrong place, we put a lot of bottles in the wrong place in Boston Harbor over the past couple centuries, where all of the sewage from Boston Harbor and the surrounding metropolitan area was going directly into the harbor.
Mm.
And when the city of Boston was sued for that, the University of Massachusetts at Boston actually established what was called then the Environmental Science Program, hired researchers from oceanography and law and all the different disciplines to support the science and the policy that was going to be needed to keep the harbor clean and to actually clean it up. So we were founded on the principle that there are environmental challenges that must be addressed, and that within academia, we have the fluidity to be adaptive and to respond to those challenges with some sense of immediacy that the industries can't pivot in the same way that we can. So the School of the Environment is actually now sort of pivoting towards a focus on those challenges that are facing the oceans around disease and human health and the issues of the microplastics that are in the ocean, and trying to work in the structured way of integrating the science, the policy, and the regulations to advance a marine economy that is truly sustainable, and to sort of build on the success of Boston Harbor and demonstrate that if you do take good care of your ocean ecosystem, it takes good care of you.
Hmm.
You know, Aaron,
Michael,
you have an ag background. So this is really the extension idea. But instead of helping out one specific industry, agriculture, we're actually just helping the ocean. So we're the extension agents for the ocean.
Okay. Yeah. And speaking of being able to break down those silos, you can then integrate that from many belief structure or holistic thinking, right, of environmental impact, seafood, better marine and blue economies. These all play into this part, which happens to be in your backyard.
Right. So you talk about a cool new building.
Yeah.
In that cool new building is the School for the Environment across three different floors. And we have faculty that are... we have a environmental health MD faculty member. We have an attorney. We've got Michael doing food solutions. We've got freshwater ecologists. We've got all of the different types of expertise that you need to holistically address a particular issue, and a structure that's unlike an academic unit. We don't have departments. And so there's no barriers to the faculty or the students moving across different problem-solving structures and actually accomplishing a goal.
And thank you for, I can tell the educator in you when you put it in my context, it's your pet peeve. You really explained it for me so I can materialize it. That was nice. Thank
good,
you very much.
Shirt.
That was good. I could tell right there. So I'm already engaged. I'm already taking notes.
There's a test at the end.
It's my show. Yeah. Michael, tell us a little bit about your background, because you recently joined the team at UMass Boston, and as Robin said, you've been focused on sustainability and food solutions associated coming from the ocean. But you have an incredible background, knowledgeable resource for the college and for the students. You've written many papers on the role of standard certifications and the potential within seafood markets and how consumers can be engaged in this. And recently you penned a new article about called The Role of Corporate Social Responsibility in Creating a Seussian World, like Seussian.
Dr. Seuss.
World for Seafood Sustainability. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about that theory and what the findings of your paper arose?
It's really looking at the corporate social responsibility. So how corporations are saying we're out saving the planet, but yet we're maintaining this economy. And in the seafood realm, we're getting quite concerned that there's a lot of overpromise and underdeliver. You know, everybody has sustainable seafood, yet we're importing 90% of it. There's kind of this disconnect happening. And, you know, the concern is that eating is integral. Everybody has to do it. It's just a biological function, but nobody wants to feel bad when they do it. You know, so if you look at over when I was little, we had food and we had junk food. Now we have food and we have superfood. We've shifted everything up to, you know, we're adjusting the bars so we feel good about what we eat, you know, and it's also kind of we don't want to poke fingers and say, oh, you're bad. Well, there actually are some kind of bad food choices out there. So in corporate social responsibility, when they're out there and they're just, hey, everything we source is great, and then a group like Oceana comes in and they find that, you know, there's a lot of seafood fraud. So they're buying one species and calling it something else. You know, a lot of grouper is a delicious fish, but you can never find a $7 grouper sandwich. So if you ever eat grouper and it's really cheap, you got to be like, this may not be grouper. It may be a substitute.
From my understanding, 60% of seafood that comes to the supply chain may be fraudulent. That's some of the estimates, and maybe you have a different number.
Well, of some species, 60% are, but when you look at salmon, shrimp, and tuna are the dominant species we eat. Those have a little bit less substitution than do, again, grouper is kind of the cause celebre for fraudulent labeling.
Okay, so these would be associated with the less valuable fish, maybe the fee.
Actually, it's the more valuable fish.
Oh,
it's
okay.
The more valuable fish because
you're
taking a cheap fish and you're trying to up the price of it by calling it something different.
Okay. And
there was actually a couple of years ago, I was at dinner with some industry experts, and we were local here in Boston, and Thai snapper was on the menu, and it was spelled T-A-I. So we're kind of like, that's kind of funny. They misspelled it. And it came out, and it was a freshwater fish. I mean, snapper again, delicious saltwater fish. And this was tilapia. And this was a CEO of a major salmon company. And he's like, no, bring the chef out. I want to talk to him. And the chef came out and finally admitted, like, if they call it tilapia, they'll sell, you know, two or three dishes a night. And if they call it snapper, they're selling, you know, 10 or 20. And so the chefs intentionally do this just to push more product through.
Do you think, talking about corporate responsibility and the folks that are involved and often benefiting from correlating the values to certain species types, are they adopting of some of these new evolutions? So yes, there's the standards and certifications, but Robin, you had mentioned things like microplastics. Like, I mean, me as a consumer, we're all bioaccumulators. What we eat is what that fish was eating. So how do groups like corporate folks, heads of corporate responsibilities that really, I think, are doing it for the right reasons, they care about whether consumers are involved, how do they get involved in a project like that? Is it to work with education like UMass Boston? Is it creating new infrastructure? How can they be involved in this equation?
Well, I think it's initiating the conversations, right? And so often the academic research ends up in some peer-reviewed journal that sits on a shelf, collects dust, and nobody ever reads, right? So working very diligently to try to get the types of research that, you know, the things we do know out there to the people who need to know them so that they can make an informed decision about whether or not they want to invest in research dollars, or maybe there's a particular you know, source of seafood they no longer, even though it's certified as sustainable, they no longer want to buy product from because there are these other ancillary issues with it that are not regulated, there's no control in the industry over, say, microplastics. But if you know that the microplastics are dominating the meats of the fish that you're selling, you should at least have the information to be able to make the choice. And that's one of the things we work really hard in the School for the Environment. I think if nationally academia is shifting to share more of that information to make sure that there is more decision power in the corporations that do want to do the right thing.
So your goal or objective is to be a bit of an intermediary. As you said, you're able to be nimble in your presentation of information that can engage, yes, consumers, yes, your students, but also with the realization that corporations, which are a major play here in the future of our food systems, the way that we're going to shepherd this regenerative natural resource of the ocean, are a major group to engage in this conversation.
Well, they have to be engaged. Otherwise, there's real, our goal is to do work that has impact, whether you're doing basic research or applied research, whatever it is, you want to make a change. And so if you're not delivering that information to the audience that are actually the change makers, you're failing.
Yeah. So, Michael, you had some time when you worked for the New England Aquarium, and you were involved in some innovative projects. You were looking at new ways of both creating startups and stimulating the innovation economy within fisheries. If I remember correctly, you had some working on things like supply chain integrity and dealing with exotics, exotic fish, of looking at fraudulent, of a way to test case this approach, and also dealing with things that are real fundamental problems within fishery, but finding creative ways to deal with them, like fleet management, where boats are, how to then harmonize that information. So you have been pushing the envelope most of your career. Do you see the college and the school that Robin has created at UMass, or the School and the Environment, the new infrastructure, the new building, what we've got in our region here for all of these incredible resources? Is this a great forum for you to continue to innovate within your interest?
This is ideal because, one of the things is just the access to students. UMass Boston is an urban campus. We are 50% first-generation college students. So it's a lot of these kids, it's a new way of thinking. And so when you can get out, I taught a class this year where we were helping local businesses just improve sustainability measures. So we were working with a gentleman who wants to farm crickets in Springfield and who would be a great member for your show.
Oh,
so, there you go. But it's getting them to think about, why do we need alternate proteins? What's going on in this space? What would it be to actually help a startup go through, this is how you produce your first 1,000 ton, and this is how you scale up to 10,000, and have them think through what it actually takes. And for some of the students, they never thought about protein. They never thought about, we're going to put 2 billion more people on the earth by 2050, which is 28%. That's a lot of people. They don't put the way they behave in the context of a bigger global issue. And even teaching them something, you were mentioning your one thing you like to do of pulling out bottles out of recycling, putting them or out of the garbage and putting them in recycling. We talk about stepping stones and just these little individual behaviors everybody can do. And so, one thing we're trying to work on more with the School for the Environment is food waste. And yes, we waste a lot of food. Estimates are in North America, 40% of food. But one of those biggest ways we waste food is actually through overconsumption and just our consumption patterns. And so as UMass, one of the things we're doing is we're putting in a new dormitory, which is going to have, we're going to have to feed kids 3 meals a day, and it's going to be an all-you-can-eat platform. So the question is, how do you have an all-you-can-eat platform, but yet be respectful of food and not have this immense amount of food waste?
I've heard, some young kids, like Robin and you, Michael, so I've heard interesting scenarios where they're trying to motivate people to look at those things differently. And to your point, often it's about awareness. I don't think that those people going and throwing their plastic water bottle in the trash or doing it to destroy the planet or because they're malicious people. It's just they're not aware of the fact that, where is that trash going to end up? What is going to be the long horizon of that plastic bottle? What is the food waste causing? What is the unintended consequences? Or what is, the empirical aspects of what's coming across by overproducing this food, right? And what we've seen, at least, and I know Babson has done some programs where they do no trays, you know, so you don't take as much because, and my daughter went up to a little training class in Maine where they talked about ecological programs, and they motivated these 12-year-old kids to say, who's getting down to zero waste? And it became a competition. Right. And you know, I don't know what the long horizon value is, but I look at that same idea as maybe in our generation where recycling became even much more mainstay. And when it became common vernacular nomenclature that we all learned, then everyone did it in their homes, everyone did it in their business, except for the people that I follow it behind the trash receptacle. Other than that, everyone else is recycling, and I think that made a huge and drastic change. So. Yeah. Robin, I want to ask you this. Mm-hmm. So we are in an interesting place. We talk about, I mean, the vast side, the U.S. as a whole, 350 million people. Mm-hmm. We're kind of a little rounding error when it comes to the 7 billion across the world. We look at the impact that's happening in fisheries and global health, and a lot of people just throw up their hands and say, what can I do? I'd rather just kind of do my NIMBY lifestyle, be stuck up in on the Cape, and I'll have my little petri dish of seclusion of luxury. But what I find interesting, and at least we try to replicate in these discussions, is the impact of our region in the Northeast is vast, and especially around ocean health. I mean, we've got some of the most reputable and well-known groups organizations, industry leaders in our space. We've got Woods Hole Laboratory. We've got where Michael used to work at New England Aquarium. We've got many of the universities in our space, from MIT to each one of the state universities, being a Sea Grant university, receiving national funds for promoting these values. So as a New Englander, we're all New Englanders here, what can we do? And looking at you as leading young generation Americans and New Englanders, what are you teaching the students to how they can be involved and how their actions matter?
Well, I think that's what Michael focused on is awareness, right? A lot of times you don't know the life cycle of the products that you're dealing with, or you don't know enough about the supply chain, right? And so making sure that people have access to that information in multitude of platforms. And so we work very closely with MIT and the Sea Grant program there to work on, you know, communication, education, programming around these issues, whether it's aquaculture or ocean sensors, you know, just to get people aware of what some of the issues are, and then empowering people. So I think a lot of times, you know, you take the global warming thing, right? And people just became so overwhelmed with the drama of it, and that it was just insurmountable. You can't fix it. And a lot of people just walked away and said, I'm not going to bother, right? There's nothing I can do to fix the issue. In fact, that's not true, right? That they've actually shown that the more you take incremental steps as an individual, the more you impact your community. The more your community is engaged, the more your city is engaged. The more your city is engaged, the more your region is engaged. And before you know it, it becomes a thing, right? So we're starting with the New England region because we do have a special opportunity by being in New England to look at these issues and try to come up with solutions. And in the School for the Environment, through Michael, thankfully, making sure that we have a global focus on what we're doing, right? That it's just not a solution that we're developing that's only going to work for New England or only going to work for the United States, but that the main driver for food security is global, and we have to make sure that the oceans are treated in a way that allows them to sustain the global population, not just regionally.
Yeah. And Michael, let's carry this on. Let's talk about food, specifically seafood, because I think Robin's point is very valid. I mean, when it comes to global warming and sea level rise, what am I going to do is the question you get from, whereas food systems have immediate recourse. There's a direct correlation for where you spend your money with practices that directly impact our shared and shrinking planet. So how do you work with your students and then the broader community to not just cultivate that awareness, but maybe some specific action items that you have queued up that are looking at engaging either the corporate leadership or other one of these organizations that we had mentioned early? You could share what you guys are working
on. Well, you know, one of the exciting things about food is, you know, people are like, what can I do globally? And every meal we're eating things from about 5 different countries. So it's like right there we have impacts. And, you know, a lot of the food is, do you have can we return back to the 1800s where farmers were producing everything within 50 miles? And is that the type of food commodity we want? And I don't think so, because people like a diversity of food. You know, they do like their fruit, that a lot of these would not be accessible to us in New England. And so part of it is this global engagement through food. And Massachusetts is great because, you know, we have this vibrant aquaculture industry and oysters. And a lot of the problems they face, so for example, when you eat, if you unfortunately eat an oyster and get sick, it's a Vibrio. But that same Vibrio species, it's a bacteria, but that also kills shrimp in Thailand. And so if we can, one of the things we're doing is working on a sensor so we can figure out when this Vibrio is growing, because they don't become pathogenic and make people sick until they're of a high number. So what we're trying to do is find a way that we can sense them when they're low of number, and that actually gives the oyster grower management options. They can either get their oysters in the deeper, cleaner water, they can pull them and make sure they're testing clean. But it at least gives them a management construct because they know something is coming down the road. But developing that for oysters in Massachusetts, we now can go to Vietnam where there's 500,000 small shrimp farmers and they're getting hit by this Vibrio in their shrimp farming. And Thailand has the same problem. And India is another up-and-coming shrimp producer. So, you know, what we're doing is we're working on these super local solutions that actually have more of a global reach.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because we've seen it even in terrestrial models where we're trying to get smarter with that approach. I mean, Listeria and E. coli and Salmonella are common strands.
Yeah.
It's when the outbreak happens, right, and they're trying to get an understanding of what's the integrity, what's the insurance that there's no foodborne illness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Vibrio being a good example. Yeah. in shellfish, where Robin, your hometown of Duxbury, ran into that,
right,
a few years,
yeah,
ago.
Yes,
and it became problematic. And it only often takes these, mm-hmm, growers who are really masters of their craft in our region, one time, or maybe they get hit a second time and they've learned from that and they are taking every method to protect the crop, right?
And for oysters and Vibrio, it's super fascinating because there's really, you know, they've looked at environmental data and there's no way to predict when the outbreaks happen. We just, there's Vibrio is still this black box and we don't really know how it operates. So yeah, we need to detect it, but hopefully through this early detection method, we'll actually begin to understand the factors that are leading up to it. And again, just helping farmers do a better job.
And we have another faculty member who's working on more of the genetic side. So she's much more of a sort of a crop scientist, right? So, you know, in the terrestrial crops, they've done a lot of selective breeding to breed, resistant strains. So she's sort of taking that approach with shellfish and looking at, are there particular components of the genome that you could selectively breed for that would make them more resistant? That then can inform shrimp farmers as well. Once she understands what it is that allows an animal to be resistant to something, how do we actually translate that to other organisms?
That's exciting stuff. I mean, when we start looking at the fact that 3 billion people across the globe are relying on sea proteins, right, and much of that still comes from open catch. It'll be, mm-hmm, us ranging, you know, going across our range in our planes, still trying to take down bovine in wild open environments. It's, yeah, crazy to think
yeah,
about. But we still are hunter-gatherers when it comes to our fisheries.
Yep.
So,
mm-hmm,
we have to go to a proper and regenerative model of farming the oceans properly. And this type of research, this type of analysis, this type of understanding built from the framework and the ground floor is really going to expedite adoption.
So it's interesting you said that we have to go as if we've never done it before. So that as part of our School for the Environment, we have a fairly good focus on indigenous knowledge. And one of the things we know about New England and the New England Native Americans is that they were always farming shellfish during the off season and wild caught fisheries during the on season. So they were very thoughtful in integrating the production of their proteins across the entire year, leveraging both the farming aspects and the fishing aspects. So what we're trying to also work on the School for the Environment is, how do we get the indigenous knowledge back out into the community, and particularly with wild-caught fishers? How do we bring aquaculture into their systems so that it's part of the way in which you are a fisher, mm-hmm, that you farm part of the year and you fish part of the year?
And that's a good strategy, because we've known that sometimes the parochial mentality of fisheries is not around being a farmer. I'm a fisherman, or mm-hmm. you know, that it's breaking down some social norms
right,
as well,
right.
Which is a trick. So, let's talk a little bit more about UMass Boston. I'm presenting that you do have a spectacular building. Your location is incredible, but you've had some rocky periods in the last year. You had some chancellor issues. You've had the brethren in Western Massachusetts that have creeped now towards Newton and Mount Ida. And I know that's still being...
They're trying to.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They're still figuring it out.
Yeah.
But it looks like things are moving positively for UMass Boston, this new campus. Michael, as you said, you've got a unique draw of the urban student, which is an incredible resource. How do things look for UMass Boston in the near horizon? Where are you at with that?
You know, so I think that UMass Boston, because it is an institution that was established in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, suffered from a lot of what construction projects suffered from in Boston at those times.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're still dealing with that legacy. And so a lot of the financial issues that we've dealt with have to do with this carrying a debt burden of 40 years worth of bad construction, where people went to jail, but we ended up still having to live in the buildings. And a very forward-thinking former chancellor who said, you know what, these kids deserve better. We're going to build. So now we have to figure out, how do we do both of those things, right? So we've actually done a really good job over the past year, over the interim Chancellor Mills leadership, to really close the budget gap, really focus on what's important, and sort of get the institution, because it is so young. People forget, UMass Boston is not Harvard, right? We have not been here for very long. Mm. So, you know, we just celebrated our 50-year birthday last year. So trying to understand as an institution how we mature under those, the inherited and the emerging financial risks that we're facing has really been great this past year, to watch UMass Boston come together as a community and try to really come back to its original mission. We are an urban public research university. We're a minority-serving institution. There are 144 languages spoken on our campus and 109 countries represented. It is a very special and diverse place, and that's where our focus should be, and less on the, you know, what our buddies out in Western Mass think they want to do. They can do whatever they want to. We have to focus on what's the best thing for our students and for the broader urban communities around the globe that we serve.
Sounds like good advice, Robin. I think that's proper knowledge to share from someone that's been there for a bit. And I mean, what I also read is for you folks in the school and the environment, that Gina McCarthy threw her hat in the ring. Not that you're counting chickens.
It hasn't been confirmed,
of course.
You know.
But that would be a huge step.
She's an alum of UMass Boston,
so
it would be wonderful. She got her undergraduate degree in anthropology there. So we would be thrilled to have Gina come home.
It would be. There you go. I like that. I can see the bumper stickers already. And I think that's a great opportunity to then continue where you've already established a competitive advantage. What you're offering for your students, something that's a very unique curriculum for them to be involved in, to have someone of her prestige and her interest and her caring for these really, moved by trying to change the things for the better for us, for our kids. That would be exciting. So I wish you luck in those next evolution, no matter how it pans out, right?
Well, we'll be good. We're school for the environment, right?
Yeah.
There's always going to be a planet.
There, yes. Well, I think guys like Pruitt may not agree with you, but maybe right.
No, there will always be a planet. The question is, do we just do something where we're not part of that anymore?
That's
I
right.
like to think of Pruitt as jobs creation for my students.
That's right. I mean, he has set them up for a career.
Yeah, that's what I told them. Life is going to be good.
That's right. That's right. There'll be a lot of things to clean up. So,
right.
Well, good. That is good stuff. Well, I can't thank you both enough for partaking in the conversation. Robin, where can our listeners learn more about what you're up to at the school and the environment?
Well, they can follow us on Twitter at ENV School. They can check us out on the web at umb.edu/environment. They can follow Michael on Twitter.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Michael, where, if there are, we have a lot of folks obviously interested
right.
in food as the mechanism, right? That's the agent of change for many folks. Would Twitter be the best vehicle for them to pay attention to some of the new information?
Yeah, they can pay attention to that. And my personal website is sustainabilitysci.org.
And that's where we'll find the Susian paper.
That is where it is.
Very good. Yeah. Well, good stuff. So I will say that if you see me standing over your shoulder at the plastic recycling receptacle, just realize I'm on your side. I'm doing it for you. We're all together in this, right?
Yeah.
So, well, again, Robin, Michael, I can't thank you enough for partaking in the conversation. It's been fun. I've learned a great deal, of course. Every time I speak with you both, I do. And I'll say maybe until next time we have our next chat.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.